Thank you very much, Otter City. It's very nice to be in Cambridge again. I've been coming to Cambridge quite a lot recently, and I always feel very warmly welcomed. And thank you to all of those who made the food. Your standard of cuisine here is almost as good as... Anyway, it's very, very, it's very, very good. Particularly like the little crumbly rhubarb-y things, which I had before. So thank you for that. So I've been asked to talk about the mandala of aesthetic appreciation. And I'm getting into this very bad habit of immediately disagreeing with the subject I'm talking about. I gave a talk recently on something which I dismissed the subject summarily in the first few sentences and was roundly told off by, quite rightly, by some of my friends. So I'll try not to do that this time, but I'm, I'm getting to that thing. So Dante's teaching on the mandala of aesthetic appreciation, Sangharakshita's teaching, is basically saying that we need to see our life primarily in aesthetic terms. That all the business of our life, including the good business of our life, the hard work, the duties and responsibilities, need to be there, but they need to be in a greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation, that we're here just to appreciate, just to non-appropriatingly appreciate everything around us. I completely agree with all that. I mean, that's a wonderful teaching, but I think it's quite easy to, as a teaching, to get wrong. My own belief, and Pamashuri might know this more than me, but my own belief is that the seminar that this is based on was given by Bhante around the time when they were building Sakavati in the 70s. So if you think of it then, you were building if you think of it then, the incredibly hard work building a building with nobody who knew, well, not many people who knew how to do such a thing, no windows, precious little floors, no money, incredible amount of inspiration, but you know, the fledglings of a new Buddhist movement. And I can imagine Bhante going to Sakavati, going to the RBC in those days. And you know what it's like when you work very hard together. Before you know it, a certain kind of culture prevails where hard work becomes almost the moral high ground. And anyone who's not pulling their weight, or perceived to be, you know what it's like. It's very, very difficult not to get into that. It's a job needs to be done. And actually, when you're in that situation, I've managed a building project. I mean, that's very true. A job does need to be done. And you need all hands on deck. But if you're not careful, it becomes kind of everything, if you see what I mean. And this is true of our work generally, isn't it? It can become everything. So I can imagine Bhante seeing that and wanting to correct that and wanting to say, yeah, it's great that we're creating a new Buddhist movement, great that we're building this Buddhist centre, great that people are being idealistic and working together, but let's remember this much bigger context, that we're not here primarily to do anything necessarily. We're here because we're here because we're here. We don't need a justification for being here. And you can imagine, can't you, in that context, that it's a very important corrective. So if I'm right, that's where the seminar, the original teaching that Bhante came from, I can really see that. And I still think it's true now, but I think it's... I think one has to take it very, very carefully indeed now. I mean, I don't know, everyone, I'm sure, you're just as aware of it as I am. I mean, and I'm not very aware of it. But I feel very aware of a damaged, divided world, a very dangerous world. I'm very aware of talking about this just after what's happened in Paris, the refugee crisis. You know, there are so, I was talking to Canute on the train and quoting somebody whose name is just saying there are so many terrible things. And at the moment, there really are so many terrible things. The danger of Buddhism now, particularly Western Buddhism, is that we use Buddhism as a kind of individual feel-good thing. There are so many terrible things, but I do a coping breathing space. I relax. I tune into how I feel. Meanwhile, the world is burning, if you know what I mean. And I'm nervous of this teaching being co-opted into that kind of rather, well, individualistic mode. There's a modern philosopher, isn't there, a Polish one, Zizek, who's saying that Buddhism is very much the philosophy for now because it suits modern individualism. That, you know, you can just work on your stress and your own personal happiness and kind of ignore the world. You know, and I was writing that on my Apple Mac, knowing full well that it's made by slaves, effectively. It's just that we keep our slaves out of sight now. From some reports, the factories in which my laptop is made by people in such terrible conditions that they throw themselves off the roof and they put nets around it to stop them doing that, to stop them killing themselves because of the bad press. But there I am in a world where I can use my laptop to shop, to go to look at what's on Amazon, to find the train times to come here. That's an incredibly divided world. And you see how if we're not careful, we'll use Buddhism to make us very comfortable. And that's good to be comfortable. I don't think there's anything pejorative about comfortable. But it seems to me a real danger that Buddhism will go to sleep. It'll just become an individualistic thing about me and me being in touch with myself and so on and relaxing, and all of which is good. I'm not saying it's bad. It's just that the world is increasingly a terrifying place. When Buddhism isn't supposed to be a retreat away from that into a private aesthetic experience, if you see what I mean. So I want to get back to aesthetics, and I will get back to aesthetics, but I want to put it in the context of a much more, hopefully, much more rigorous approach to Dharma practice. I wanted to put it in the context of wisdom, because the Bhante seminar comes out of the Ratnaguna Samgacchayagata, which is a wisdom text. So what Bhante is trying to draw out there is how to practice wisdom. So the first thing I want to talk about is how the first thing, there needs to be a shared transcendent spirit amongst us. This shared transcendent spirit comes originally from the Buddha teaching the five ascetics. It's very striking when you think of those five. They were living together, practicing together, talking together. I can't believe that they can all have just been like it looks, you know, just asking questions of the Buddha and the Buddha answering. I bet you they went off at times and said, what on earth do you think he's saying? And I bet you they were reacting at times, and I bet they were disagreeing. They were doing the sort of stuff that we do together. I bet they were. All that gets airbrushed out of history, you know what I mean? And you get these sort of rather sweet-looking creatures nodding agreeingly and sort of doing that a lot. You know? But I bet you it wasn't like that. They were very smelly for a start off, which doesn't get documented either. So they're living together in close contact with nature. They're basically, when you think of it, it's the first Buddhist retreat. It's the first ever Buddhist retreat. Except for instead of the Rupa, you've got the Buddha himself. Instead of us, you've got the Buddha's direct disciples. But it's the first Buddhist retreat. Living, practicing together in the context of Kalyanamitra, the most incredible Kalyanamitra, the Kalyanamitra of the world, sitting with you so you can talk to him and he can talk to you and you can talk to your friends about what he's just said. It's like an archetype of Buddhism, really, in itself. It's what the Sangha really means. Tomorrow I'm giving a Sangha Day talk, and I'm thinking, well, that's what the Sangha really is. It's not a group and so on. It's that kind of spirit. That spirit is living. It can't be reduced to a set of teachings, to a set of techniques or formulae. It's a living spirit, which you can never pin down, which you can never adequately describe, mysteriously alive, between you. At our best, we're in touch with that spirit. I remember many years ago now, I was at an order convention, and sometimes on the conventions, there's a palpable spirit between us. You know, I go on an order convention, and, you know, I'm a rather critical person, and I think, there's so-and-so, and there's so-and-so, you know. I wish I'd stayed at home and seen a film. The usual sort of stuff. And then gradually, you know, you warm up. And before you know it, there's this incredible atmosphere between us, which is quite palpable, but extremely subtle. You wouldn't necessarily notice it. I wasn't going to say any of this. I've not actually even looked at my notes yet, but never mind. I may actually not, because they don't usually help. Anyway, let's run with this for a moment until you all sort of nod off. And two things I remember from this particular order convention. One was that one night I didn't go to the puja. Shock, horror. Hope that doesn't disappoint you. But at the end of the puja, I had to come back to come and collect my blanket from my bed. And as I was going into the puja at the end, a lot of the order members were coming out. It's the end of the puja. And the atmosphere that had developed between them in that puja was quite palpable. I mean, I could almost see it. And the reason why I felt it so strongly was because I hadn't been expecting it at all. I was just going to get my blanket so that I didn't get cold at night. I was just on a, you know, oh yes, look at the time, they'll be finished now, so I'll just go and get my blanket, you know. And as I went to the shrine room, it was in Wyndham, where, you know, and it was just a converted gym, you know, one could almost smell the plimsolls. As I went to get my shrine gear, coming up to the doors of the gym, you could almost see waves of atmosphere coming out. They were quite a palpable, transcendent, shared atmosphere flowing out of the room, which actually was like walking into water or smoke or a kind of light. Now, I'm not terribly given to this kind of thing. I come from the Midlands. And anyone in the Midlands isn't allowed to have these kind of experiences. They're ejected to somewhere in the south or the far north. But in the Midlands, we don't do that sort of thing. So you can trust me, folks. I'm not, you know, I'm not into Planet Mung Bean, I can tell you. So I was really struck by this atmosphere. Very, very, it really did actually touched me. Yeah, it was quite palpable and sort of quasi-objective. It seemed to have been developed between people, but was its own reality. Quite definitely, I mean, unmistakably. And then the other thing I remember from that retreat is where Banti was going to come in. I think we were doing one of his birthdays or something like that, I can't remember. And they said, well, Banti's coming in. And we all stood up to wait for him. And it was quite a long, well, not a long wait, but we were waiting some time for Banti to come in. And as we waited together in the room, in this converted gym, as we waited, an atmosphere just arose between us. And so many people I asked about it said, oh, yes, I know exactly. There was this sense that this was all the order ever needed to do, is stand up and wait for their teacher. That's all we were doing. It was like a metaphor of the whole matter of being in an order, was a shared community, a sharing a transcendent spirit in relationship to a teacher. Just as those five ascetics shared that in relationship to the Buddha, we were sharing in that directly, unmediated, a direct teaching outside the scriptures, I can't quite remember. It wasn't to do with words, it was a shared perception. And all we needed to do was wait for our teacher to arrive. And there was this hush amongst us. And then, you know, Banti came in, sort of quite old, elderly and frail, and completely unassuming, as if he hadn't noticed that we were all waiting for him. And then once he was there, the Sangha was complete. So The first thing I think we need to really be in touch with and protect and cherish is that shared transcending spirit. It can only arise when we're together. I don't mean shared as in Facebook, by the way. share. like. Oh, look. My meditation got 3 likes. And 1 that don't like. It has to be like this, together, in a room together. Has to be shared in that sense. And it only arises to the degree to which people are receptive to it and themselves trying to orientate to it. But when you say it, you can never say what it is. Inspiration is the word that Sabuti has been using, but for me that's too inspirational. It's like a certain kind of spirit, a certain kind of atmosphere. If you're in touch with that, and to the degree you're in touch with that, everything else can just gradually fit around that. Everything else will come along. I've been teaching a lot, you know, I've written these 2 books, whatever they're called, Life of Full Attention and The Journey and the Guide, and they're about trying to help people practice day to day. And it's really valuable to think about practices and particular applications, and here's what you do in this meditation, and here's what you do in a walking meditation to work and so on. Nothing wrong with that. But without this shared spirit, all of that is just so much self-help, really. A valuable self-help, and we do need to help ourselves, and there's nothing wrong with that. But without this shared spirit, it's only what it is. It's only, you know, a breathing space or a mindful walk. It's no more than that. You can't reduce Buddhism to any of its parts. As soon as you lose touch with this shared transcendent spirit, what tends to happen is you start to want to identify Buddhism with a bit of it, with studying the Pali Canon or practicing of mindfulness or whatever else, or ecology even. You try to want to say, well, this is what it is, this is where it resides. So really the first thing is to share in a spirit, and I hope on this urban retreat, the more and more you can come together and share in a kind of spirit, the more, you know, the more we'll start to create Sangha. Yeah. So to share in that spirit, we need to be reflecting on wisdom. We need to be cultivating wisdom. The first thing we need to do is we do need to study. So one of the things I could really recommend you do this week is study, do some more study. At the moment I'm leading the Journey and the Guide at the London Buddhist Centre, and it's been going very, very well actually. We've got 65 people on the course. What's been striking me is that we've kept a lot of people as well. They're all about pretty much still there. What's been interesting me is quite a lot of people have been doing the practices, the meditations that I've been suggesting, the walking meditation, the breathing space, but not very many people have been studying the book, reading the book. And I'm kind of struck by that I think in modern life we increasingly don't particularly see the value of study. We sort of, the tendency of modern life, this individualistic tendency, is to value, even overvalue, even primarily value personal experience. As if personal experience is kind of primary, as if all you need to do is examine your personal experience, and just by examining your personal experience you'll get to the truth. Do you see what I mean? But personal experience is based on your views, your deep underlying patterning of views, and your experience changes depending on your view. So something that Bhante has been teaching, Sangharakshita has been teaching all of this time, but I think it's something we still haven't quite understood, how view creates experience. So that if we just try and look at our experience, we'll never get to the bottom of it, because it's created by view. So I'm trying to think of an example. So I remember once meditating, not a very good meditation, and halfway through it, for some reason, my meditation sort of opened out a little bit, and I just suddenly thought, or found myself thinking, I don't know what's going to happen next in this meditation. And then I thought, I never know what's going to happen next. I never know. None of us ever know. We think we do, but we never know what's going to happen next. And just for some reason, because that thought had come in from the side, from a slant, into a more concentrated state, suddenly my world of experience changed. Because I had a dharmic view in the midst of it, I suddenly thought, I never know what's going to happen next. And you never know, and we never know. Just bringing in that insight reflection, that wisdom reflection, completely changed my experience. Like, completely changed it. I seemed to be, for a moment, outside space and time, outside me and you, outside self and world. Just for a moment, I left the whole shooting match. And then as soon as I noticed I had, I was back in it again. So, experience is underpinned by view. View isn't a really very good word for it. It's more like a deep instinctual patterning, which we take to be reality. So my example, I may as well just forget my notes. For example, I seem to be better at examples than anything else. I've got these children in my life, Alex and Rhea, two little girls, except for they are definitely clear that they are not little. So I said to them, I said to one of them, I never expect to have little girls in my life. She said, I'm not little. So never mind all that. That is an insult. I'm not little. And I went to pick up Alex from school, and she wasn't very keen on me picking her up from school. And when I went to get her, she wouldn't hold my hand. And she wanted to walk in front of me. And she said, nobody knows who you are. I think you're like... And I said, well, why don't you just say I'm your uncle? She said, well, I've already got three uncles. As if having a fourth was unimaginable, you know. That nobody in their right mind would have four. I said, well, you know, I could look like your grandfather. She said, I've already got a grandfather. You know, it's like... And she walked past a friend of hers and she said, he's not my dad. In this kind of weird conspiratorial whisper, he's not my dad. So very, very funny. And then as we went out, she said to me, everyone's looking at us. And I looked around and there were a few seven-year-olds playing on the playing field, and there's one or two children being... Nobody was looking at us. Nobody gave her monkeys, if you just mean. I was really struck by that, her saying that, and her conviction of that. And I couldn't say anything. I couldn't say, well, but yeah, but what do you think? Because she thought what she thought other people thought, her peers thought. She thought people were all looking at it. It was no good me saying, no, they're not. Look around. That was true for her. But it's a view. Do you see what I mean? It's just a view she's picked up from the playground, but it meant she wouldn't hold my hand. Yeah? So that's what views are like. You pick them up from the playground. And that playground can be reading The Guardian, being at work, your family, your friends. You pick up views and you think that they're true, that nobody knows who you are, that everybody's looking at us. You think that is the truth. It's just a view. If you think everyone's looking at you, and if you have to say, he's not my dad, then it makes you feel really uncomfortable. Yeah, but and you can explore that feeling of being uncomfortable as long as you like, but it will never get you to reality, because actually it's based on a view. What you have to do is look at your view. View as in this sense of a deep psychic patterning on which you construct your life. And that deep psychic patterning on which you construct your life even constructs a me and a you, a self and a world, a time that I'm living in, all of those sort of things. They're all built on view, on a sort of archetypal vision of what you think you are and what you think life is. But it's empty in the Buddhist sense. It's not a reading of reality, it's a construction, it's a fabrication. So the primary way of working with that is studying the Dharma. So really getting to grips with primary Dharma text. I think particularly for us studying Bhante's presentation, we should be studying as much as possible the, you know, the broad text, but it's, Bhante's got this genius for saying here's what's really important. He's like a filter, otherwise you've got a lifetime of reading, never mind anything else. So he can tell you what to reflect on. So we need to, first of all, really make sure we've really understood the Buddha Dharma, and that we keep coming back to that. Because you can understand it for a bit and then you lose it. Then you need to then regain it. And you, when you lose it, you can't even remember what you understood. You've had this experience coming back from a retreat, probably, where you felt so inspired and so in tune with something, so aligned with something, with what I'm calling a shared transcendent spirit, that you feel, I really know where I am, I know what my direction is, I'm now in this sangha, and this sangha is always also a dharma. But you know what it's like, you, a few weeks at home, and you can't remember what that was, and you can't even recreate it in your mind. It's not an idea. You can't think, you can't even remember the talks that were given that were so inspiring. Even if you watch them on video, you get the information, but you don't get the inspiration. You don't get the atmosphere that you felt so aligned with. It's a very odd experience, isn't it? You just can't remember what it was. You could even give a talk about it, but you can't actually, you're not aligned with it anymore. You're not patterned with it anymore. So we have to keep on going back to studying it again, reminding ourselves about view. And that is constantly trying to undermine our erroneous views, our fabrications, and put in that place a surer dharmic perspective. Much more difficult to have than we think. It's very easy to think one has Buddhist eyes, but one so often doesn't. Reminds me of reading Rilke's letters on Cezanne. He says at one point, and suddenly I had the right eyes. He's looking at paintings, Cezanne's paintings, day after day, and suddenly I had the right eyes. And it feels like that sometimes in a meditation, on a retreat, perhaps on an urban retreat, perhaps in the middle of a talk, and suddenly one has the right eyes. You suddenly feel this alignment, this sense of purpose and meaning, this sense of knowing who you are and where you're going and what life is, and then you lose it. So we need to keep on coming back to a real understanding of the Dharma, then keep on trying to reflect on that in our life. Part of that reflection means having friends around us who'll reflect it back to us. Friendship should be a kind of provocation. Kanan Michitol, auspicious friendship, needs to be loving and inspiring and encouraging, but also provoking, even disturbing, even unsettling. So I was on the public preceptors meeting with Padmasuri just the other week, and I started saying something to Satyaraja, and he said, Maitreya Bhandhu, don't start with that. And he just completely told me off. It took me completely aghast. He just said, he's very straightforward, Maitreya Bhandhu, don't start with that. And I thought, I've been told off, I'm 54, I've been told off. I've grown up. But then I found myself thinking, yeah, but it's fair enough, yeah, that's good, yeah, that's a good point, I see what he means. And then I, you know, later in the day I thought, yeah, he did say that, and I think that's fair enough, yeah, no, I was starting with it, quite right. And then I did that again, I thought, I wonder whether I seem to be reacting. Because I keep saying it's fair enough, but I've said it like 4 or 5 times now in my mind. It makes me think that I might be, you know, it was, I felt saying, I say, you know, I thought we were mates. But it's just slightly sort of like being nipped, you know. I mean, if you ever had it with Bhante, I mean, Padmasuri, you all know this. You know, Bhante can do it in a way that nobody else can do it. I remember I went for a walk with Bhante, and he said, Maitreya Bhandhu, I've been thinking it would be good if you led these men's intensive meditation retreats. Because Karmashila is going, I won't do the whole impersonation, Karmashila is going away for a while, I'd like you to lead them. So I thought, but I demurred. You know, I said, you know, my meditation's not very good, I demurred. He completely ignored me. I have never been ignored so thoroughly in my life. There's even the word ignore doesn't get to it. It was like it was unsaid. Like my words just were sort of dragged into a black hole. And he said, well, on the first day, I'd like you to introduce... I think... it was just like somebody had taken the tape of reality and just cut out what I'd said and just carried on with practice. I mean, it was quite an experience. I've never been ignored. It was just like... He wasn't even going to say, you know, that's a note. He's basically wanted to say, that's you. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the Dharma. Can we get back to the subject? But he didn't even deign to do that. He didn't even deign to flick me away. I just didn't exist. And so the first day I'd be thinking, yeah, you know, I just thought, oh, I hadn't said it. So friendship needs to have this provoking aspect. Not provoking from, I don't know, bad temper on the part of your friend or anything like that. We've had plenty of that in the past. Sure, we'll have it. Well, there's always new ways of letting off steam with someone. I've discovered that even having non-self can be a way of bullying people. We used to manage to do it in metta, but now we're even managing to do it in non-self, which is quite something, really. Anyway, better not get me onto that one. Otherwise, Sataraja wants to say, Maitreya Vandu, don't start that again. He would have to upbraid me. So part of reflecting on the Dharma, part of taking that study and deepening it, is practicing it, living it out. A vital part of that is being around people who are doing that as well, and who'll be willing to relate to you on that basis. Yes, they'll be kind, yes, they'll be loving, but actually the most loving and kind thing is to help you go for refuge to the Three Jewels. My other great example of it more recently was when I was doing a 3-month sabbatical to write a book. Jnanavacha, my great friend, came in the middle of it after me writing the book for 3 months, every day, like all day. He read the manuscript, went off with it, read the manuscript, came back and said, I'm not impressed with the manuscript and I'm not impressed with you. I was like, I mean, it was like a full Vimalakirti Dineshya moment. He just said, so I want you to stop writing it. I think you should stop. And I was absolutely flabbergasted. I'd just spent 3 months writing this wretched thing. And he told me, you should stop. I want you to stop. In fact, he didn't even say, I think you should. I think he said, you must stop. And I had this real strengthening moment where I realised that was true, and I really wanted it not to be. And so I said, okay. I said, okay, I won't. I've never looked at that book again. But looking back on it now, it was an act of supreme friendship. Only your very closest friends will stand against you like that and say, tell you what is not doing you any good and tell you what I don't think it's worth doing. So can you stop, please, and go back to doing more meditation, And actually, the last part of that sabbatical was infinitely happier than the first half. All kinds of things have arisen out of that moment. Even, for instance, writing poetry has arisen out of that moment because I stopped writing this dreadful theoretical book, which I'm just not very good on theory, as you can see, because I'm not even looking at notes. I was trying to come up with an argument tonight rather than just my usual, but anyway. I'm not very good at writing theory. It doesn't suit me. So I stopped doing that. I meditated much more, had more time doing nothing. I started writing poems again out of that nothing. And it's that that's grown, not writing theory, you know. But only a very good friend would do that. So part of deepening the Dharma is getting your friends to keep mirroring the Dharma back to you. Otherwise, we're all just going to become not a Sangha with a Buddha. And good heavens, what a presence a Buddha must have been amongst that first Sangha. Not that, but just a group, a social group. Very often a middle class, middle mannered group. Nothing wrong with being middle class, but it's not a Sangha. Yeah, it's not a Sangha. So the main things I'm saying there is, first of all, let's really make sure we're studying the Dharma, studying it at its cutting edge, wisdom teachings, compassion teachings, what the Buddha said. Then let's reflect on it in our lives and try and put it into practice amongst a community of people who are also doing that and are willing to step into our life quite vigorously, and we're willing to step into their life quite vigorously, kindly, encouragingly, but quite vigorously, on the basis of the Dharma. Yeah. So that's the first thing I want to suggest for this week. As if that's not enough. My second thing, this is all in my mind about how do we deepen wisdom. How do we therefore get close to the Ratnaguna Sanjayagatha, which is what Bhante's seminar is based on, and then how do we find beauty out of that? The first way is to study, reflect on that, what we've studied. How we reflect often is in relationship with other people. We need ourselves reflected back from a dharmic point of view. The next thing we can do, and again it's contextual, it's to do with us, is practice what Subhuti calls reaction practice. So that you notice when you stiffen up, when something happens and you react. Either you react with aversion, or you react with craving, or you react in some other way. But when you bristle, when you stiffen up, when Satyaraja says, Matra Bandhu, don't start that again. You catch that pride. In a moment, it's pride, and then it's interesting that how wily pride is, so that instead of feeling that directly, I think, oh yeah, that's fine. But the fact that I said it in my mind at least three times tells me that it's not fine. So there's pride, there's egotism arising. That gets you right up close, if you can catch it, to the very thing you're trying to see through. Do you see what I mean? When you react, that's when self-clinging, which is a terribly Latinate and technical word. The word the Buddha used was conceit. Much less Latinate, much less flattering, conceit or pride, mana. That's when it really rears up, isn't it, when you react, especially to other people. So one of the things you could do this week to cultivate wisdom is to notice reaction. Like what I can notice for me is I get jealous sometimes of my friends. Sometimes I get jealous of my friends being with another of my friends. I can't decide who I'm jealous of. But I feel strangely left out and I want to be their friend and, you know, that sort of thing. Jealousy is a private thing. Usually we don't admit to it. I tend to say everything I've ever thought about out loud in front of large groups of people. But I don't recommend following my lead on this one. It gets into terrible trouble. But when you react, do you know what I mean? You really see, this is the matter that I'm trying to see beyond. And there's plenty of opportunity for it. Plenty, you know, in a crowded train, when you get cold, when someone doesn't agree with you, when someone criticizes you. Look for when you stiffen and bristle. Try and stay with that. Don't sort of moralise it. Don't even think you shouldn't feel that. That's just a response to having a view that you really exist as a really existing entity in a really existing world. It's fully fabricated. If you didn't have that view that you really exist in the way you think you do, you wouldn't have that response. And those who are more developed don't have that response so much. Or if they do, they manage it very well and very quickly, and they catch it and see into it. But it's like, reaction is like a borehole drilling down to your core egotism. Because very often we keep it buried, don't we? We've got lots of cotton wool between our core egotism and our life. We live an incredibly wealthy and privileged life. And there are so many terrible things. And we're in this little bit of the world that at the moment is very, very comfy. It may not be for very much longer. It may already be the beginning of the end. But at the moment, for most of us, comparatively, it's very, very comfy. So there's lots of padding between what happens to us and our egotism. You know, as long as we get enough organic veg and croissants, we're kind of all right. I was saying on the Gukyaloka retreat that we're never more than 20 minutes away from a croissant, are we? You know, eventually we'll have something that alarm goes off if we're more than 20 minutes away from a croissant. You are now out of range of a croissant. You know, on the Eiger, you know. Oh. No organic veg from here. Nothing wrong with organic veg and croissants, etc. So you see what I mean? That because we're in a very cosseted place, we don't feel our naked egotism very much. And if we get what we want and we're relatively wealthy and things go our way, we can feel that we're actually pretty impressive, because we've not really been tested. We're not really hitting the bedrock, the kind of fossil ground of our egotism. Sometimes very striking when you're ill. You suddenly, that fossil ground of egotism is terrifyingly exposed. You can just suddenly see the rock of your egotism. And what you want to do is, by hook or by crook, you want to defend that egotism. Also, you can see it when you've got children. You extend that egotism to your child. So I remember carrying one of the girls once and somebody banging into me. You know, I was like I felt like a wolf. You know, I would have gone for them. You know, that incredible protective instinct. Yeah, so the second thing we can be doing to move towards wisdom, which is what the Ratnaguna Sanchargatha is teaching, is really be alert to where we react, see if we can stay with it, feel it directly, and try and see into it, use it as a borehole to see what is it that we're trying to protect. Where is this self that rears up and puffs up? Where do I feel it? What's it about? What's it doing? Can I see that it's a construction, and can I let it go? Easy to say now when I'm standing in a centrally heated historic theatre. Not so easy when Satyaraja says, Maitravani, don't start that. So the third thing, and finally we are getting closer to this mandala of aesthetic appreciation. The third thing I want to recommend is nothing practice. So I've already talked about wisdom practice, which is studying the Dharma neat, in the sense of neat whiskey, reflecting on the Dharma by putting it into practice, and by your friends reflecting back your Dharma practice, and you being quite explicitly willing for that to happen, for you to open the door to them and for them to open the door to you, and for that to be an ongoing matter. Then on the basis that, you want this kind of ability to notice reactions, use it as a borehole to see through to your innate conceit, your self-infatuation, your self-clinging. Try and see that it's a construction in the moment. Try and see it there where it's actually rearing up, rather than this very cosseted, cotton-walled, protective way that we usually experience it. Then you start to see the beast itself. Whatever you say in your mind, you know it's not true. You know you really exist. Whatever you think you can say, underneath it, basically you think you exist. I've been doing this much more in my own meditations, trying to get down to that fossil level of, yeah, but I insist I exist. This is a me. I can do all the reflections that I've been taught to by Buddhism, but that's all great. And then if I attend, underneath that is, yeah, but I'm kind of me. And this is me, you know. So you're trying to get through to that. So the third practice then is doing nothing. It's nothing practice. And this takes us, I think, into the terrain of the broader mandala of aesthetic appreciation. So in this practice, you just do nothing. So this is something we could all do this week, is find some time to do nothing at all. I was saying somewhere recently that Bhante apparently spends time every day doing nothing. So you just do nothing. And when you do nothing, you're really, again, challenged by your desire to enact yourself, to be a self by acting one. Self is constructed, fabricated, and it's fabricated very much by action, by doing things, by buying things, by making choices, by etc., etc. So you try to notice how much you want to take rebirth, is another way of putting it. That instead of just noticing the nonsense, the stuff and nonsense that's going through your head, gosh, some of it isn't even recyclable. Instead of noticing that, you want to take rebirth in action. You want to do something. I mean, all you need to do now is, you know, flick your thumb, and you can buy a book or download something into the palm of your hand. You don't even need to do much. Soon you won't even need to do that. So can we not reenact self? Can we not take rebirth for a bit? And what you feel is that you can feel yourself wanting to do that. It's a bit like sitting on a spring for a while. You can feel yourself wanting to bounce up into action that restates I am a me doing a this. Because that's what self is. It's I am a me doing a this. And this is the sort of thing a me does. This is the sort of thing I am. We kind of play the role of ourself. We enact ourself. So in doing nothing, you try to feel that desire to enact. Then what tends to happen is you feel this boredom. And you try and stay with that boredom. So Buddha's been pointing out that boredom is a threshold feeling. It's what you feel as you start to cross from one consciousness to another. You just get bored. Your superficial stimulations, you're no longer reacting to. So you can feel that actually, basically, you're just there's, you feel sort of bored. There's something missing. You feel incomplete. I was really struck in the film we went to see on Friday night, the Steve Jobs film. A lovely the best line in it was his daughter confronts him at the end and says, well, why didn't you recognise I was your daughter? And the character says, Steve Jobs says, I'm badly made. I'm badly made. And that's what we're trying to get to in ourselves. I'm badly made. That I'm incomplete. My operating system is a fabrication. It doesn't work. I'm badly made. And it's an uncomfortable sensation to come to. And it can create a sense of ennui, a sense even of pointlessness, because you're not enacting. So if you're not enacting, what are you? I think, again, this is what happens when you're ill sometimes, especially when you're very ill. I was recently visiting a friend of mine in hospital. You know, poor man, it was like being tortured. And a very, very intellectually alive man, and, you know, being patronised by all the nurses, because he's a very elderly man. He couldn't bear it, but he couldn't act. He couldn't enact himself. He's a writer, he's a poet, so he couldn't write. He couldn't act to create himself. And there's just this whole awful sense of, what am I when I'm not enacting myself? When I'm not taking rebirth into a self. So you try to face that, you try to stay with that, and you try to die into it. You try to spiritually die into this urge we have to be a someone. Even reflecting is not necessarily what you want to be doing here. Sometimes reflections arise, but you're not trying to reflect even on non-self or something, because sometimes that's just another way of enacting self. You're trying to just die into this uncomfortable feeling that if I don't do anything, am I in anything? Do I just sort of disappear? So I think on the basis of those three things, on the basis of studying the Dharma, really getting to grips with the Dharma as it's taught, and that means keep getting to grips with it, falling away from it, getting to grips with it again. I have to do that. The more I study, the more in tune I am, the more aligned I am with that transcendent spirit. If I don't study enough, my alignment shifts. I mean, I'm in this sort of context a lot, so it doesn't shift too much. But you can give talks like this and still be out of alignment. Study brings you back into that alignment. It's almost like something sort of to do with the stars. You know, the North Star of the Buddha is there or something. Try and get that back by studying, by reflecting, by having yourself reflected back dharmically. Then try and, on the basis of that mining of view and trying to replace erroneous fabricated views with a more dharmic view, even that's not enough because eventually you're trying to get to no view, but let's not go there just now. Try and after you've done that, you try to notice that actually your real view, let's go on with that a minute for a moment, your real view is that I exist. Whatever I've read about the Dharma, whatever I've read about non-self or insight or metta or all the things I'd like, underneath all that is a bedrock assumption that I exist and I must be protected above all things. You're trying to get down to that bedrock level. One of the key places to do that is when you react, because that's when you get a borehole down to that level. Can you stay with that bedrock level? Can you, just as you would in metta, can you work directly with it rather than just think on top of it? And then, as a way perhaps of aiding that, can we just do nothing? Can we not enact ourselves? Can we have time where we're not being a someone doing a something, which makes us feel like a someone doing a something? Can we just die from that? Feel the discomfort of not being able to do that? I think if we can do those three things, what we'll be doing is practicing spiritual death. Quite genuinely, we can be confident in that then. And I think the more you practice spiritual death, the more you experience beauty. That's the whole point. The reason we practice spiritual death is to give birth to the Bodhisattva. It's to give birth to a transcendent spirit, which in that transcendent spirit always wants to go out and help the world, an increasingly divided, terribly frightening world. That's why you want to die, so that you can be of service to the world. So looked at morally, that's service to the world, love, compassion, the Bodhisattva. Looked at aesthetically, it's the experience of beauty. Again, I take Bhante as my kind of archetype. If you read the memoirs, if you read him in seminar, what you see is somebody exquisitely sensitive to beauty. And obviously, for Bhante, beauty is a very important reality in life. Think of all of those of you who read the memoir. Think of all those churches he's visited, one after another. You know, it kills you. You go, and you go around Florence, and you end up being sort of dragged around. I mean, I'm quite an arty person, but you know, I would not want to go to Florence with him in his heyday. You know, I remember once. You know, so it's on that level. Churches, Florence. You know, it's incredible what he remembers. You know, he'll read whole poems out to you and all that sort of things that he's kept with him and knows them really well. I was talking to him, trying to convince him about how good Seamus Heaney was. He said, too many potatoes for my liking. So you get this incredible cultural refinement, which is not to do, remember, with the fact that he's a middle-class boy. He's a working-class boy from Tooting. Incredibly culturally refined. Like, beautifully, incredibly sensitive to beauty. And then I remember going to Birmingham. In Birmingham, there was that sort of park. What was it called? Cannon Hill Park. And there was just in front of the doorway to the Cannon Hill Park was a great big cage full of exotic birds. And Bhante, this was before he lost his sight, Bhante like marched up to it and just stood like staring at these birds. We stood there for ages, and it was like being, my experience of being with him in that moment was like being with a mixture between an 8-year-old child and St. Francis of Assisi. Sort of both seemed to be there. He was just like completely absorbed in them. I said, oh, look at that one. Oh, yes. And he said, oh, look at that one. Yes, very pretty. You know, oh, yes. You know, we stood there. I think, okay, we've done exactly. But he was the incredible childlike openness to it. And enraptured by these little birds. It really was like St. Francis amongst the birds. So his sensitivity to beauty, I mean, he's extremely sensitive to birds. I remember when I took him to see Vajrasana when we first bought it, and his eyesight was failing then, and I was showing him around the grounds, and there were leaves blowing on the floor. And he said, are those birds? And I said, oh, no bird, but they're leaves. But he's very sort of, he's actually extremely sensitive to bird life. So what you see in Bhante is someone incredibly sensitive to beauty in all its forms, physical beauty included. And I think that's what happens when you spiritually died. That what he's trying to teach us there is, to the degree to which you spiritually died, you see the world as beautiful. You see it as beautiful, you're motivated by beauty, you're responsive to beauty, so that you see those birds and you walk straight towards them and give them your full attention. You live in beauty. That's what spiritual rebirth is. That's why Bhante's been teaching the arts to us so long. He's been trying to say, this is what the world looks like when you started to let go of self. To the degree to which you're in touch with this self-transcending shared spirit, what you see around you is beauty. But you can't see that beauty unless you're trying to work on these other three things. Unless you're studying the Dharma, putting the Dharma into practice, working with your reactions, and doing nothing. On the basis of that, we can enter the mandala of aesthetic appreciation.